Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Wednesday, December 12th, 12-12-18. Michael Cohen, who has pleaded guilty, was sentenced to 3 years in federal prison today in a courtroom in New York. And he admitted that Donald Trump had been right in calling him weak, but for the wrong reasons. So Cohen is this guy, kind of street smart New Yorker, the kind of guy who loved to get in people's faces and talk about how, you know, he'd take a bullet for Donald Trump. Well, that all changed when he fell into the clutches of the Russia investigation. And there ain't much Russia in the Russia investigation. Sure, Michael Cohen was trying to get a hotel deal going in Moscow, but the original claims of Russian meddling in our election and that Michael Cohen somehow facilitated that, well, if there's evidence of it, it hasn't surfaced so far, including his admission of guilt in a courtroom today. Facing Judge William H. Pauley III, who said that Cohen had committed a smorgasbord of crimes involving deception, motivated by personal greed and ambition, the judge said, as a lawyer, Cohen should have known better. And Cohen stood up and ate some crow. I blame myself for the conduct which has brought me here today, and it was my own weakness and a blind loyalty to this man, referring to Trump, that led me to choose a path of darkness over light. Now, some of this is comical, all right? Michael Cohen is not a guy who was ever drawn to the light or the right side of things. He is a predatory, greasy fixer and a guy who enjoyed the greed that he shared with his boss, the Donald. Now, Trump infamously tweeted recently that Michael Cohen was weak and that he should serve a full sentence, unlike the other people that Trump wants to see get off lightly in this massive and metastasizing corruption syndicate. So, Cohen said the president had been correct to call him weak, but for a much different reason than he was implying. And let's see if I can get this to work quickly enough that it won't draw the attention of the YouTube police. But here's what he continued to say. It was because time and time again, I felt it was my duty to cover up his... Yes, it was my duty to cover up his dirty deeds, rather than listen to my own inner voice and my moral compass. Now, unless he has had that compass recently surgically installed, there is no indication that prior to this time, this moment of judgment, that Michael Cohen had a moral compass. And then he apologized to you and me, the American peoples. You deserve to know the truth, and lying to you was unjust. Well, putting aside the, you know, kind of phony misery and apology of Michael Cohen, he has provided critical information that I believe supports the impeachment of Donald Trump. And Trump can be indicted for these issues after he leaves office. I support the effort to indict him while he's in office and test that with the Supreme Court. But I don't think anybody else has much appetite for that. In addition to the critical campaign finance violations related to the hush money that was paid directly by Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels' lawyer and paid indirectly by the National Enquirer to the attorney for Karen McDougal. And I heard Rush Limbaugh again this morning trying to defend Trump using Trump's talking points, saying, hey, you know, it's just a private transaction. It's just a non-disclosure agreement. This doesn't have anything to do with the campaign. Well, that's total bullshit. It happened in October, at the height of the campaign. And it is clearly a violation of the campaign finance laws. Now, Trump, as he often does, flatly refuses to admit that he's done anything wrong. And he says that, hey, you know, this was just a private business deal, a simple private transaction. But in case you don't believe that bullshit, he also maintained that even if the hush money payments were campaign transactions in violation of election regulations, they should be considered only a civil offense, not a criminal one. I don't believe the campaign finance statute is written to allow for civil infractions. I'm not a lawyer, and I want to confess that I have not read the campaign finance laws recently. But I think that Trump is making things up there, as he is so wont to do. So Cohen admitted he had arranged for an illegal corporate donation to be made to Trump when he orchestrated that $150,000 payment by the National Enquirer, American Media Incorporated, to a former Playboy playmate. And this is where Limbaugh's claim that it's just a private non-disclosure agreement is just false on the face of it. They induced a friendly corporation to pay this woman off to buy her story and to sit on it. It accomplished the same as the hush money paid to Stormy Daniels. But in this case, Trump didn't pay it. And I believe it is clearly an in-kind contribution by American media to the Trump campaign. And as such, it is a gross violation because the contribution would be capped at $5,000, not the $150,000. And so it goes. Now, the other Mike, who was a central player in the first week of the Trump administration, before he ran afoul of the FBI, Mike Flynn is due to be sentenced later this month, I think on the 21st, so more than a week away. But last night, Rachel Maddow, who is so obsessed with this stuff, she briefly replayed the scene from the White House where Pelosi and Schumer had their televised argument with Trump over the wall. And then she dove into the memo that was produced by Mike Flynn's lawyers, arguing that he's been so cooperative and he's so contrite that he should serve no jail time. And my opinion is that his lies to the FBI about his phone call or calls with the Russian ambassador Kislyak are not that significant. And in a moment, I'm going to lay out what I believe is a good argument that Mike Flynn was entrapped. And Rachel Maddow went through these documents. She laid out some of the same factors that I'm about to lay out for you. And she never for a moment suggested any kind of entrapment or unfair investigation of Mike Flynn. Now, let me begin by saying that I think Mike Flynn is an idiot. And he was an idiot before Trump made him a national security advisor. Barack Obama fired Flynn as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, where Mike Flynn knew which phone calls were intercepted. He knew that the Russian ambassador's phone was completely tapped 24/7, 365. And so I don't condone or rationalize his lying to the FBI. But we're now learning, and Maddow went through these details on her program last night, that the instruction for Mike Flynn to call Kislyak came from Mar-a-Lago. The call was made by Katie McFarlane, who left the Trump administration about the same time that Flynn did. She was like a communications advisor to the National Security Council, and they moved her on to some other job. Now, she apparently told the same lies that Mike Flynn did. But she was able to amend her statements and has avoided any further heat, as far as I know, from Mueller or other investigations. And so, when you look at this, Flynn was instructed to make this call. I believe he was on vacation in the Dominican Republic when he was instructed to do that. So he made the call. I don't know exactly what he said to Kislyak, but the leaks indicate that he did reference the sanctions that Obama had recently imposed related to the alleged 2016 election meddling. And he advised the Russians not to react to it. We're also learning that he lobbied on behalf of Bibi Netanyahu in the state of Israel, asking Russia to oppose the Obama administration's move, at the last minute at the United Nations, to not oppose and vote present on a resolution condemning Israel for its continued expansion of settlements in the West Bank. Russia didn't apparently respond to that because I don't believe they changed their vote at the UN Security Council. So fast forward, January 24th, just 4 days into the Trump administration, Peter Strzok, who is now infamous as a top dog at the FBI, he went to the White House to interview Mike Flynn. Now, for the first time, the New York Times is informing me, and I've been following this case pretty closely, that Andy McCabe, the number two at the FBI, called Flynn before Strzok and another agent went to the White House and told them that they were coming to discuss Flynn's communications with Russian officials as part of their investigation into the so-called election meddling. So Flynn indicated that he knew that American intelligence had been listening to Kislyak's calls. When the agents arrived at the White House, an easygoing Mr. Flynn offered to give them a tour. One agent reported Flynn was unguarded, clearly saw the FBI agents as allies. My view of this is that he didn't feel that he had done anything wrong, and he probably felt, bring it on. So he was offered the opportunity to have a lawyer from the White House counsel office sit in on this meeting, and he said, no, I'll talk to you. And from there, we only have the reports of the FBI agents. Now, McCabe has, this is now being reported by the New York Times, decided beforehand that the agents would not warn Flynn that it was a crime to lie during an FBI interview because they wanted him to be relaxed and they were concerned that giving warning might adversely affect the rapport. It might also unspring the trap that one can construe was laid for Mike Flynn in that interview. Now, I'm happy to see Flynn out of the Trump administration. I have no regard or respect for him. But as I look at this, you can construct a plausible case that he was set up by the deep state. And keep in mind, Obama had fired him from the DIA. One of the few things we know, advice that Obama imparted to Trump was, don't mess with Mike Flynn. He's a disaster. So Trump ignored that advice. And again, you can see a plausible scenario where the deep state said, okay, we're going to take care of this. Now, again, I don't have proof. What I'm offering is speculation and theories. But my criticism is that Rachel Maddow laid out the same fact set that I just gave you and never speculated about the kind of entrapment that I'm discussing. And I cannot figure out why Mueller has gone soft on the Turkey angle. Flynn accepted $500,000 from a client who was lobbying on behalf of Turkey, and he failed to register as a foreign agent. He was plotting a kidnap of Fethullah Gulen from Pennsylvania to Turkey. And that's just, who cares? You know, he lied about a phone call with the Russian ambassador. So then I turned to The Guardian. And a little bit later in this podcast, I have something nice to say about The Guardian. But I don't trust The Guardian on many reporting issues, like Trump-Russia and like Syria. But when it comes to reporting in the United States, they can do good work, and we'll get to that in a bit. But they did a recap. What has Robert Mueller told us about Cohen, Flynn, and Manafort? And they go through each of these defendants, and they describe, what is happening to them and what their testimony or disclosures were. And there is no indication other than in the introductory paragraph here that refers to Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible collusion. There is no evidence cited from these three individuals that would support a collusion claim. And as I mentioned earlier this week, I think the Maria Butina case, the suggestion that Russian money was pumped into the NRA that then spent it through a media firm that was also running the Trump TV ad campaign, that's a very serious set of issues and allegations. But the central claims that have been pumped up by The Guardian, by The Post, by The Times, oh, these many months, are now quietly receding in the coverage that we see in the corporate media. Meanwhile, we're facing a very unstable world right now. The U.S. is just one part of it. We know what's been going on in France. Macron is on his knees. And Theresa May is now facing what she didn't expect. Her own party, the Tories, the Conservatives, have called a no-confidence vote and scheduled it for tonight. In fact, as I speak to you around 2:30 Pacific time, this vote may be underway or may have taken place in the Parliament. I don't know the outcome at this point. But 48 Conservative members signed on to letters of protest, and Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, had been talking up a no-confidence vote, but apparently didn't have quite the ammo that he needed. And under the party rules, Theresa May needs to win about 158 votes in a secret ballot to remain as party leader and hold on to her job as prime minister. And if she does, her party cannot mount another challenge to her leadership for 12 months. But the Brexit package is stalled. There is not enough support to do anything, to reject it, to approve it, to amend it. And so the British government has descended into a kind of lockdown. And ejecting Theresa May could be the most likely way that this deadlock is broken. We'll be watching carefully. Every day I pause for a moment to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Sandra Fish. Let me turn the page here. Also, Joe Carson, Carl Howard, and Johnny Jump, John Forward. I appreciate the money that you kick in every month, $5 or $10, sometimes $20. It makes a big difference. It pays the bills here and gives me the validation I need to keep ranting and raving on a daily basis. And the holidays are here. People are often very generous. They get bonuses and share them a little bit. So if you're in that position, come on over to peterbcollins.com. Click on the menu tab, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll land on the sign-up page. And it's easy to take it from there. Allergic to PayPal? Yo comprendo. You can communicate with me by the U.S. mail at Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Bernie Sanders is finally doing something that I criticized him for in the 2016 campaign. He's taking a strong position on a foreign policy issue. I felt that was his biggest weakness. Here he was challenging Hillary Clinton, who'd been Secretary of State and used her foreign policy experience to burnish her candidacy. And the lamest, you know, the only attack Bernie made was, well, she voted for the Iraq War. I believe he may have mentioned Libya and Syria in passing, but it was never a strong theme of the Sanders campaign. So today he is leading the charge on a war powers vote in the U.S. Senate to withdraw support for the Saudi-led coalition fighting in Yemen. This is in part payback to Mohammed bin Salman for the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi in the Turkish consulate, the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. And I commend Bernie Sanders. This is the first time since that they have invoked the 1973 War Powers Resolution in ages. And this is the furthest that such a resolution has gotten in the Senate. So I hope we see this measure pass, and I'll follow up on that when I have more information. Now, I just said something nice about Bernie Sanders. Here's one of those issues where I can never understand. And it supports the claims of his far-left critics that Bernie Sanders was a sheepdog who was herding progressive Democrats into the clutches of the corporate centrist Democrat machine. Well, Bernie Sanders never challenged the way they rigged the primary, they rigged the campaign finance, the money that came. I've talked to you about this before. George Clooney, went to a dinner with Hillary, and he and his wife gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Victory Fund, and that money was controlled by Hillary Clinton's finance chair, who also was running the finances of the Democratic National Committee. Now, it's different, but similar to what I just described about Trump, that the NRA TV ad campaign was being run by the very same people who were running Trump's campaign. So these issues deserve to be fully exposed. And the Becks filed a lawsuit challenging the DNC and claiming fraud. And the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the Beck lawsuit may proceed. So they found jurisdiction, they found standing, and I hope that we see full disclosure of the shenanigans that were under the auspices of Debbie Wasserman Schultz and her coterie back in 2016. Also, I'm pleased to report that the folks at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth have updated me on an important legal advance in the effort to discover the truth about 9/11. On November 7th, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York notified the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry that he would comply with the provisions of federal law requiring him to present to a special grand jury the Lawyers Committee's reports filed earlier this year of unprosecuted federal crimes at the World Trade Center. This means a 23-member grand jury vested with subpoena power and the authority to take sworn testimony will hear the voluminous evidence of the World Trade Center's demolition and will have the ability to conduct a thorough investigation that results in indictments against suspected individuals. In other words, what the 9/11 Truth Movement has been working toward for 17 years. Now, this does seem to be a signal development, and I will continue to follow it. And if you're new to the podcast, let me recap my position. I have carefully investigated the work of the 9/11 Commission. I attended their public hearings in Washington, D.C., and I came away quite dismayed. It was, in fact, a cover-up. I do not claim to know who the real perpetrators of 9/11 were. I do not easily just say, oh, it was an inside job. What I know is that we've been lied to, that the official report is loaded with misinformation, misleading data, and they suppressed the testimony and evidence brought by many individuals. And so I'm a truther. I don't duck it. I don't try to soft coat it or sugar coat it or soft pedal it, whatever phrase you like. I know we've been lied to, and I demand the truth. And here's one guy we'll never get it from. Rudy 9/11 Giuliani. He profiteered on the deaths of individuals in New York, the carnage at the World Trade Center. He was the guy who approved the move of the New York Emergency Command to Building 7. And Rudy Giuliani was just ruthless and brazen in trying to capitalize on his work as the mayor of New York. Tried to propel himself into America's mayor, a presidential campaign, and now he is cashing in on his volunteer work as Trump's lawyer in the Russiagate story. He was cited this week in Manama, Bahrain, meeting with the king and the interior minister of this U.S. ally. And he's been making the rounds, promoting Giuliani Security and Safety, his company. He's been dropping into Africa and South America. Oh, there's no dictator he wouldn't love to take a check from. But Giuliani, reached in Bahrain by the New York Times, said that he's not capitalizing on his representation of Trump. And get this, you know how Trump has said he's probably the least racist person you'll ever know? Well, it rubs off on little Rudy. I'm probably the most ethical person you ever met. I follow all the rules. I have no desire to trade on anything. Oh, yeah. And then we've got Ivanka and Jared. Ivanka has been promoting what are called opportunity zones. This is where they give tax benefits and inducements to people to build in areas that have been written off. It's a great opportunity for huge profits. And the Kushner family owns a real estate investment company or a big stake in Cadre. Cadre recently announced it's launching a series of Opportunity Zone funds to build major projects under the program from Miami to Los Angeles. Oh, those Trumps. They're just at the trough. they're just raiding the Treasury and fleecing the public in every possible way. That scandal in North Carolina over the absentee ballots that weren't mailed in or that were filled out by people who weren't the voter and mailed in, well, it goes deeper than just the general election in November. The New York Times reporting that back in the primary, which occurred in the spring, the incumbent Robert Pittenger lost narrowly to Mark Harris, and that the votes from the rural Bladen County, or I don't think they say Bladen down there, Bladen County, and this shadowy guy, McCray Dowless Jr., who specialized in trafficking in absentee ballots and loved to help people fill them out, well, it seems that the primary was won by this guy Mark Harris by only 437 votes. No, let me take that back. The margin of victory was 828, but Harris won 437 of 456 mail-in ballots from Bladen County. So this is just another indication that there's a lot of fraud, election fraud, perpetrated by insiders, not voter fraud, as the Republicans try to mislead us on a regular basis. Over at my colleague's site, whowhatwhy.org today, a new podcast that I recorded earlier this week is released, and we take a look at Bill Clinton's welfare reform back in the 1990s. And my guests include former welfare mom and Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, and the author of a new book about the Clinton welfare reform, whose name is Felicia Kornbluh. And it's a fascinating look back at the horse trading that occurred, the role that Newt Gingrich played when the Contract with America passed and the Republicans took control of the House in 1994. It's a little depressing, too, because both Woolsey and Kornbluh acknowledge that things haven't changed, that Bill Clinton abandoned the poor as a key component of the Democratic base, as he chased the wealthy, the middle class, the corporate donors. And we have more people in poverty today per capita than we did when Bill Clinton was president. You can catch the podcast, no subscription required, at whowhatwhy.org. Now, Ayanna Pressley is an incoming Democratic African-American. She's got great braids. She's from Massachusetts. She defeated a longtime progressive, McQuan, I think his name was. Anyway, Capuano, I'm sorry, Michael Capuano. At any rate, she was speaking at a Democratic National Committee fundraising meeting in Washington the other day. And she went off message a little bit. I know, given the new people that we engaged in democracy, that we have restored hope for many. We've given hope to many, and we must do everything we can to keep that hope. She touched on the importance of having close proximity to marginalized and vulnerable communities. And I read this very carefully. She never actually mentioned poor people. But I think that's what she's referring to. And she says, are we really who we say we are? Of all the negotiations and decisions of our day, will we go in the direction of worry, weariness, or indifference, or in the direction of joy, peace, equality, and justice? She went on to say that I know I'm making some of you uncomfortable, but that wasn't my intention. I'm okay doing that in the name and pursuit of progress. Those young people are demanding and expecting more from me. I owe it to them. I ran to fight for the ignored, the left out, the left behind. And that is not only true for the electorate. Together we'll do that work, beginning with our own party. Now, wheeling and dealing, Nancy Pelosi wants to be speaker, and the negotiations include a term limit imposed by the Democratic caucus. Now, I thought she was going to serve until 2020 and gracefully bow out. But she's holding on for more. She wants to serve 4 years as Speaker before allowing a change of the guard, including booting out Steny Hoyer, who's almost as useless as Mike Pence was in the White House yesterday, and James Clyburn of South Carolina. So I think these negotiations will continue, but I think that Pelosi would be wise to make her exit in 2020 and not try to push it further. The New York Times, in a lengthy report today, says that the cyber attack on the Marriott hotel chain that collected personal details on 500 million guests and passport information on 300 million people, well, the opening part of the article flatly says it was conducted by China. Chinese spies hacked into the Starwood Networks, and that is the chain of hotels managed by Marriott. And later in the article, they do admit, while American intelligence agencies have not reached a final assessment of who performed the hacking, a range of firms brought in to assess the damage quickly saw computer code and patterns familiar to operations by Chinese actors. But they don't mention Vault 7, the CIA hacking tools that allow you to hack in and leave the footprints and fingerprints of somebody else. No, we won't do that. And finally today, I get to the article by The Guardian that I praise. Yesterday, as you know, the CEO of Google, Sundar Pichai, was being grilled on Capitol Hill. Not much changed. He soft-pedaled the claims that their search engines are biased against conservatives when a congresswoman said, "Why is it that when I enter idiot in the search window, a picture of Donald Trump pops up?" And I think that does deserve some explaining, too. But what's fascinating is that The Guardian reports today that there are two classes of workers at Google. 50% are full-time employees, and the rest are what's called TVCs. David Bowie predicted this with his great song in the 80s, TVC 1-5. Google employees are categorized as TVC if they're temporary, they are vendors, or they are contractors. They don't get paid the same, and one of the most grievous offenses that is cited is that last year, this past year in April, there was a shooting at YouTube, which is owned by Google. And when that occurred, the company sent real-time security updates to full-time employees only, leaving the TVCs out of the loop. They were then excluded from a town hall discussion the following day. The TVCs wear red badges, and when there's an all-hands meeting at the Googleplex, they're not allowed to join in. They're also not allowed to be given T-shirts or other goodies when they complete a project, because that might leave Google liable for co-employment, a relationship between two or more employers in which each has actual or potential legal rights and liabilities. And so, Googlers, I await the rebellion of the red-tagged TVCs, erupting in Silicon Valley any day now. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.